Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Probably episode 6, maybe episode 5 of a famous maritime story or marine story, the Iron Monarch. There were two ships, sister ships built, Iron Monarch and Iron Duke. I'm going to cough a bit here. And it's a fantastic story. It's a story of 1970s engineering coming to the fore when we thought we could do everything. The Americans were landing ships on the moon and Australia was generating a ship. A jet engine powered gas turbine, as they call it, basically we call a gas turbine, so the jets, jet engine, state of the art iron thing, very advanced concepts, and the rest of Australia is falling apart, and they've gone into beautiful stuff, and they've built this really complicated process. Which is not really good enough to control this engine. And it's got heaps of trips and things like this. Okay, now, we'll start the story here. I signed off at Port Kembla on the 5th of February 1974. Ralph Brown from GE Gas Turbine signed on in 74 in Melbourne and signed off at Melbourne also in 74. I assume he didn't know what had occurred, so he called for assistance. Leo Buckley of the GE Drive Systems Salem VA, whatever that is, Vermont, I suppose, who designed and built the Speedtronic, and Ralph Brown, the electrical engineer from Gas Turbine Department, joined the ship at Port Kembla in the 23rd of 2nd, 74 to sort out the problem out. Leo was a circuit card designer, and a pipe smoker. There you go. He had two pipes and was known as the engineer as Two Gun Pete. He last sailed in the SS Bogon in 66, which had a GE COS system. They spent time on the ship trying to find out what was causing the problem. Ken Farrell had noticed the problem occurred after the light went on in the fuel processing room. This was answered that this couldn't cause a problem until finally checked it should be investigated. It was found that somebody had taken the internal Speedtronic 24 volt supply out of the panel to power a relay on the fuel processing system. The coil in this drive was failing, and when it was energized, it dipped the 28 volt enough to cause the trip. There was much jubilation when the cause was finally found. This is the hardest problem to solve of any experience on these ships, and it was well that the CE had an observant eye. I never found out who the idiot was who did this magnification. Leo Ralphen left the ship on the 4th of the 3rd in March, 4th of March. Oh, the 3rd, isn't it? March? February, March of 74. The ship used distillate fuel for the first 200 hours before waxy residual fuel was gradually introduced. This allowed the engineers to master the water washing of the waxy fuel. During one changeover, it was found that a section of the piping was too cool in the waxy oil to flow, and this caused to flame out. The piping was heat traced to cure the problem, whatever that means. Chris Derby, so there you go, that's... Yeah, mad invention. The Americans had spacecraft blowing up here. They'd been on the moon several times, and we were trying to get a jet engine powerboat around the place. Chris Derby, BHP engineer, was given the task at Port Kembla of installing and dedicating the house fuel tank for waxy oil. Fuel deliveries were by road tanker until the installation of a direct fuel line from the Ro-Ro berth, whatever that means. The power changeover from diesel to shaft alternator again caused problems. Leaving Port Kembla, November the 14th, 1974, when the ship blacked out three times, C mode changeover can only be performed from number 3 diesel. Peter Lamarck said these blackouts became so common that the vessel never changed to sea mode until at open sea, with no other shipping nearby. Bridge officers were put through special blackout procedure drills, basically the sub-picture game, which the engineers could do normally, so that the flow to the rudder would permit steering. Oh my God! Can you imagine? So this was a trip, and the ship would just list around. Oh my God! Electricity restored. Once available, either from the shaft or the diesel, then all the equipment had to be restarted, numerous alarms sighted, with only emergency lighting. Flashlights were kept handy for the bridge console. This is bizarre. Another problem to occur was the failure of the expansion joints between the turbine and the regenerator. The design was not able to withstand the extreme exhaust temperature of the other rudder covering started to show signs of heat failure. The gas turbine department came up with an improved design, John Manville joint, which was a major job to install. Keith Fennell from AGE office was given the job to arrange to complete this work while the ship was in port. The ship also suffered from some cracking due to more than expected expansion in the exhaust duct area. Cracks appeared in the wells between the support pipes and the installation ducts. Inspections in the first 1,000 hours of operation found no problems with the fouling of the compressor apart from some salt streaks which were removed by water washing. Bore scoping the unit indicated no problems with other components. At 1,000 operating period hours, the fuel nozzles were changed over for cleaning, and although there was some build-up, this was considered normal. It was found that the atomizing after the air cooling tube assembly was found to be leaking water to the fuel nozzles. It didn't appear to be causing any problems. A new design tube bundle was introduced to correct this problem. The disc shaft brakes suffered cracking from 3 radial holes drilled in the rim to allow easier handling. Originally, rolled steel plate was changed to a forged 5K1055 steel plate without holes and brindle hardness. Oh, that's really bloody hard. 150-90 brindle. This appeared to cure most of the initial problems. As time progressed, the borescope inspection indicated some rough edges on the HP bucket tips. This was reported to the gas turbine department, who were not concerned. Whenever gas turbine department visit was available, I showed them the bucket view, as I was always querying the rough edges on the tips. Checking the HP buckets, the borescope allowed a good view of the leading edge of the tip side view. However, it didn't allow full view of the bucket thickness due to the narrow gaps between the tip and the shroud. On the borescope check on the LP wheel, a section of the bucket leading edge under the platform was found missing as a result of a small section of a second stage nozzle dislodging and hitting the bucket. I rang Gaspar, who advised not to run the machine. This wasn't an option, as Bob Moffat and I didn't think it was enough to stop using the machine. The manhole was cut in the exhaust frame to gain access to the wheel, and the damaged area was blended with a small grinding wheel. This has never caused any problems in future operations. BHP had hired Qantas to inspect the turbine on a regular basis, which was always thought would cause confusion, as an aircraft gas turbine is a different beast to a heavy-duty gas turbine, especially one burning heavy fuel. There wasn't much love between Lossman, Qantas and myself. I never saw any of their reports, so I never saw they were reporting. It seemed a waste to me. Bob Moffat, who was the Port Kembla superintendent at the time, always had an interest in the ships and asked me if I wanted to go with him into the turbine. Always good for a new adventure. I had sometimes doubts about crawling through the central airpiece. The central air section of the regenerator and climbing down the compressor discharge pipe on a piece of rope with some knots tied in it, into the turbine casing, and observing the condition of the external surface and the transitional pieces of the first stage nozzle. My only fear was, if the ship sinks, I'm dead meat. Another Bob Moffat story, although I wasn't there involved pressure testing the regenerators by baking off the combustion air pipe flanges and applying compressed air to measure the rate of decrease of pressure and thus the leak rate. This involved obtaining a large portable air compressor and hoisting and hoisting to get the air to the regenerators, which was a massive job. I cannot remember the result, however. I think there was a sound of air hissing out of the cracks, and the pressure couldn't be raised enough to measure an effective leak rate. Another series, and this is where you need, you really need Freon. They didn't have Freon. Freon was excellent for finding leaks. Another series of mysterious trips commenced, which defy any explanation. There's no obvious cause, and there was a complete loss to find the problem. I put Rick Allen, a technician from our Sydney office, on the ship with an oscilloscope to monitor the VMP master project card trip points to see if he could find the signal was tripping the unit. He didn't have any luck tracking down the fault, so I went to Port Kembla with Brian Ladd, another technician from our office, to have another look. I remember my days at the Bank of New South Wales computer suite when we had a similar weird problem with the GE235 computer suddenly acting strangely and then correcting itself for a time before failing again. This was caused by major backlog of the bank's output, and there was not in press. The fault was finally traced to a sliver of wire from a pin wrapping touching the ground backplane, thus occasionally grounding the signal in the move control command operation. There you go. This is valve wiring. My father was built Cyrac, which is far more reliable than that. I decided to check out the wiring around the VMPA card area, which was very packed, and probing around with a pencil. Then suddenly, a loose termy point, a clip used to hold a wire to the card pin, flipped out. The factory and panels are wired on an automated machine, however, for wire gauges in the field. A handgun is used and are not easy unless you're very experienced. There have been a lot of changes on this panel, I assume, at the gas turbine department, where the operator was having a problem with his turbine point gun and leaving loose clips in the wiring and thus able to short the card pin. I sort of understand that there's these wire wrap pins and you wire wrap them around. I used to really love that. The little gun, and it's with stuff, and you just pop around the place. Really great fun. How many trips this problem caused in the past is hard to say. However, I think it was a recent movement of the ship as the clip in the wire mass at that time that started the trip problem. I think Bob Moffat later found more loose clips when looking around the wiring. Bob was always having a go at a problem, and I liked investigating. The next major problem arose in April 1977 when, while a bore scoping holes were found on the suction side of the HP buckets, which indicated that serious erosion of the bucket wall had occurred. The fired hours at this stage was 11,200 and 640 starts at a ratio of 24-4. Oh my God, look, that bucket is just... That bucket is absolutely corroded. There's a picture of a HP bucket corroded. I don't know what a HP bucket means. The ship was sent to Cairns Cross Dry Dock for a bottom clean and the turbine to be stripped for a major inspection. A major inspection involves removal of the top casting, lifting the rotors, inspecting the bearings and other components. The Whyalla shipyard stripped down experience, which I hadn't seen, was evidence as the turbine components were stacked on the staging room, staging in the engine room. However, a HP bucket problem, it was found that the inner diaphragm, which sits between the turbine stages, had suffered failure. The bronze strips fit into the grooves machined in each end. The aluminium bronze strips control the cooling air, also prevents hot combustion air escaping into the wheel space. The problem was identified by GE, who had issued a technical letter, TIL 359C, in August 75. The bronze seals were affected by corrosion. Sulphur was identified as a major problem, with the elements in the air of the fuel contributing to the problem. The seals were replaced by 410 stainless steel. The iron monox strips were extremely brittle and distorted, with sections missing. This may have caused the FOD to the second stage bucket previously mentioned. The seals would have been replaced which was a problem as a replacement material had to be located. The unit was taken away so the old strips could be machined out. The diaphragm was found out to be round. The original bronze strips were replaced by stainless steel strips. The same repair was required for the first stage nozzle support ring. GE at this stage had developed the RT22 coating material for the IN738 buckets, the first stage nozzles, and designed to increase the component life. The buckets and nozzles were changed, were coated with new components. Some damaged buckets were returned to GE Gas Turbine Department for analysis. A report received back in June 77, which confirmed that the buckets had suffered extensive low-temperature, high-temperature corrosion from sodium, vanadium, and lead. Lead was a new factor that was never checked. I later found that used motor oil had been used in the wax oil supplies to the lead. The washed fuel logs had shown sodium at 1 to 2 parts per million, 80% of the time between 3 to 5 parts per million, for the remaining 20%, while vanadium was normally 0.5, and sometimes reaching 2.2. The lead was never measured. The bucket addition shown in 44. So there you got this high thing, you've got these elements coming in. After the ship re-entered service, the next problem which appeared was the cracking of the hot gas regenerator caused by the heat cycling from starting and stopping. This was a serious problem as it allowed the compressor air to leak directly into the exhaust air and dramatically reduced the turbine efficiency. Extensive weld repairs were commenced, however, the problem was never defeated. A representative from Harrison Radiator Camera Company assisted with the repair procedures. During July 1980, GE Gas Turbine Department designed a modification to convert the ship to a simple cycle which redirected the internal turbine airflow directly to the turbine stage, which removed the regenerator function from the airflow system. Modifications were made to the speedtronic power control setting as more fuel was required. The result was the loss of efficiency and an increase in fuel consumption. The ship's speed was reduced to 16 knots with this problem, and this modification would increase the speed to 17 knots. The ship departed Newcastle. It was a slow chugging ship with a completely stopped engine which has been ripped apart by the periodic table. Due to the slowdown in the business cycle, increased fuel consumption and lower speed, the ship was laid up at Lee Wallace's Newcastle in 1983 and offered for sale. This may have been the end of the great ship until it was decided to replace Australian National Line ships Liat Endeavour and Liat Enterprise carrying slabs from Port Kembla to the Western Port Works. The Iron Monarch was selected over the Iron Duke, possibly because it was Newcastle and the Iron Duke was from Sydney. The Iron Duke was also had a serious damage to one of its diesel alternators. GE Harvey of Newcastle won the contract to re-engine the ship. She was moved to July 15, 1985 to the Western Basin for work and commenced removing the gas turbine regenerators and storing two Warsteller 12V medium-speed diesels rated at 4,095 kilowatts each. The conversion cost over $6 million. To carry earlier subs, the cranes required modification to magnet lifting. The work was completed in June 1986 and the ships were re-entered service in July 1986. Now, I can tell you, 1986. So the ship. So those gas turbines were just one hell of a nightmare, wasn't it? Okay, with 75, operation of the gas turbine ro-ro ships. And I don't know what a ro-ro ship is. Ro-ro-ro-ro boat. Captain Peter Lamard was the first master of the Iron Monarch, had been a great assistance in putting this part of the story together. He's always been eager to provide details, including his notes and drawings. The first area we will investigate is the difference between these ships. He had provided his descriptions on why these ships needed different ship handling techniques. Ship handling with gas turbines. No doubt there are other ships who have fixed speed engines and maneuver with cam wire or similar types of variable pitch propellers. But it is far more the norm. We ship's officers and pilots are trained to handle vessels with right hand turning fixed pitch propellers and diesel or steam engines at very speed, slow, stop, reverse as requested. So this is the whole thing. A gas turbine could only operate at a fixed speed, and so they had propellers. The standard situation in this vehicle that turns the bow to subo quite sharply in many cases when the engines are going astern is due to the propeller pass acting on the rudder. This traverse thrust greatly assists the port side berthing of most ships. Come in at an approach angle 30 degrees. When a couple of the ship's lengths from the desired stop point come astern, engines and the time the vessel reached her berth all the way had been cancelled and the ship was laying parallel with the wharf. Run the lines and heave her alongside. Also, many river ports around the world have, for a century or more, been turned into short round to starboard, an examiner's invariable question. Starboard helm, engine head, getting dangerously close to shallow heads. Midship's helm, full astern, and traverse cut accelerates the starboard swing until the stern is getting close to another riverbank. Starboard helm, and come ahead again, and so forth, until she's round. This traverse cut is maximum with the vehicle in light draft. So this, not only having fixed speed, variable propeller pitch, it was a dog to thing. On balance, Ro-Ros were lovely ships to handle. A block coefficient of less than 70% means that they have fine hulls. They speed up quickly, steered beautifully, as long as they were there was water flow over the propeller, 2 to 3 knots headway. Scaled a few masts, scared a few masts with near misses until they learned to get the pitch restored after the turbine trip or blackout. Obviously, if a zero pitch propeller blocked all the water flow to the rudder, the vessel would shear off windward. The disadvantage with the propeller always turning, I probably would have not sawn a buoy chain in Port Kembla. I would not have sawn the buoy chain in Port Kembla if I had not been able to ring stop engines before we struck. Even so, it was dumb to be so close to the buoy. I don't quite understand this. This is a person who, oh my god, oh, the propellers are full of cracks. As well, the big problem at all ports was the refusal of the line's launch to come in for a stern line while the engine was running and the propeller turning, even though neutral pitch, as can be seen, the stern house with house, funnels and stern ramp caught most of the wind. If the wind was coming off the shore, it would catch at 22. I could not shut down until we were positioned in the skewed berth, unable to land moorings aft if the engine was running. The tug assisted would overcome the problem in some instances. So, not only it was a big sailing ship, the wind would blow it around. This is absolutely annoying. Eventually we gathered, and this is amazing that the ships now have huge propellers, you know, pointing off to the side. Eventually we gathered techniques. Would throw the launch a heaving line and he would take the ropes from a safe distance. Even so, it always remained a hazard area, and to this day some timid linesmen will not take our stern lines. The other difference, of course, with the engines turning clockwise, our traverse cut was to port, not the conventional cut to starboard. Realising that the shipyard had set up the ramp to work the starboard side of the wharf, so we were always able to use the port traverse to thrust our advantage during berthing. So the turbine horsepower gave us a magic stopping power, could pull up better than any other ship in my experience. Considering her many round voyages, she survived many scary scrapes and probably has a better safety record than other ships of that vintage. All the southern ports we traded to were noted for wind-exposed wharfs. One experience Peter Lamarck had in Port Kembla Inner Harbour in March 1974 was an example of what could happen with a continuously rotating pillar. The railroad berth, which was still under construction, number 2 cargo wharf, was being used. There was a row of green marker buoys marking the shallows in figure 45. Oh, God. Peter describes the instance, quote, "I miscued and the westernmost green marker buoy was sucked under our counter. I could not see from the bridge, but the second mate said it sounded like a loud screech and propeller soared through the buoy's mooring chain. MBS later sent a bill to replace the chain." Okay. "We berthed and shut down and went to inspect the propeller, which was not a pretty sight. We could not get a good deal of propeller out of the water to make any repair. We lowered the ramp and Derek Slim Steve Dorr started loading the cargo onto the forward holds for as long as he could. Eventually, the ramp was too high, so the ballast was removed from the aft tanks. Port Sup Noel Shearman organised the barge to work for the engineers and used a turning gear to rotate the propeller so each blade could be inspected. I would say that 6 centimetres of each tip was torn ragged like a shark's teeth." Oh my God. "Providentially, the Stones engineer at Wailata for the Iron Duke sea trials, and he came to Port Kembla to have a look. He was a capable person and expressed the view that he could fix the problem without a dry dock. Over the next 2 days, he had a gang working around the clock, cutting, grinding, beveling damaged blades. He performed great balancing feat using nothing more than experience to set a set of scales. We discovered on our return to sea the smaller diameter gave us a small increase in speed and thankfully no vibration. The incident was my darkest moment." So they just ground off his propeller. Isn't that amazing? Another accident. The Iron Monarch, called the Port Kembla Cut Incident. The Iron Monarch, under the command of Captain Ian MacLeod, Jeff Herbert as mate, and Cliff Allen as chief engineer, cast off the railroad berth at 7 a.m. one Sunday morning in perfect weather and hardly any wind. Passing number 1 discharge berth, the turbine tripped, however. It cannot be recalled if the main power was lost. At this stage, it was assumed that the diesel set should have been running. The decision was made to drop anchor to halt the ship within the inner harbour or the section between the outer harbour and later excavated the dredge of the inner harbour. That decision was influenced by the presence of a pipeline crossing the eastern end of the cut. The ship probably had enough moment to carry through to the outer harbour and the risk of anchoring there, however, was thought to be too risky. In the go. After bringing the ship to a halt, tugs were requested, but only one was on call and had not immediately available, nor was a lines boat. It was not normal to have a boat for letting go more lines. The port lifeboat was lowered and the bow line was run to the south bank. It was brought to the bow thruster. It wasn't available due to power loss. My godfather. You can imagine warships. Next line from the bow to the northern bank and put around the power pole was carried all cables providing power to the coal loader conveyor belts on the coal berth. As the line was tightened, the cables were squashed, so the harbour master, Mick Dunn, requested that the line be shifted. The next line from the port quarter to the northern bank, but the breeze sprang up from north to south to drift the stern towards the southern bank of the cut, which unfortunately made it harder for the lifeboat to drag the line over the northern bank. The seaman was put on a lead line to the starboard quarter. His sounding went from about 5 fathoms to a light dew as lead line landed on the bank. About this time, the line boats turned up to help put the port quarter line ashore and was closely followed by one tug, which held the ship until the second tug could be obtained to shift the ship back to the berth. It was a nice day to spend on a Sunday. It was believed that the propeller had touched the wall of the cut with no damage. An underwater inspection at Bell Bay was conducted by McLeod squeezing into a wetsuit and with a professional diver determined no damage had occurred. Well, there you go. That's a story, wasn't it? Ramp problems and stories. I'll read this and we'll finish off here. The Isle of Monarch always had a problem with the threshold plate, a hydraulically operated plate, to fill the ramp. The gap between the ramp was down and between the ramp upper edge, and the door couldn't be closed off fully, and had to use threshold hydraulics to force the door shut. Lloyd's was very unhappy about the problem, however. It was only approved when it was demonstrated that it could finally be closed, with the door status indicated on the bridge, which depended on the limit switch, which only indicated closed after the door push rods had dogged the door home completely watertight. The first accident occurred on the first voyage when the straddle truck damaged the primary cable, which required modification to the buffers with painting yellow guidelines. One of the first problems to occur was a failure of the ramp to drop under its own weight. When the ramp was closed, it was over centre and required two hydraulic push-out rams to move it to a position where gravity would take over. The hydraulic systems were designed such that one ram would take the lead, with the result the ramp structure would twist. A crossover balance line was installed to maintain equal loading of each ramp. Okay, yeah, I can imagine that. Due to the failed grease line installation, a ramp bearing seized had to be replaced. The repair required the ramp to be held in position by welding steel support lugs to the ramp and installed. An oxygen lance was used to blow out the rusted steel pivot from the pin core. Once the heat had reached the bearing, the cooling was rapidly applied and the pin shrinking to break the rust bond and bearing. The pin was then removed from the hydraulic press. The grease lines were replaced, with some were repositioned. The areas where the wharf couldn't take a full ramp weight and it had to be supported by winches in auto worked very hard as they were just every time to straddle past. A funny story concerning the ramp occurred when Garnox and Port Kembla were doing some welding repair work on V deck, which required them to bring their truck with their welding units onto the vehicle deck, special permission required. After completing their work, they retired to the bar for a drink. There was no cargo work at 6 p.m. The mate raised the ramp at 10 feet for overnight security. The hour later, the welders departed, doing a nightly leap off the end of the ramp to judge welders. So they didn't understand what was going on. That was a funny story. Well, this is just, you know, Australia has never really, Australia has been a land of these absolute disasters. How we've got the mine, how we've built anything in Australia is just amazing. So I'm just going to read, this is pages and pages and pages and pages and, oh, there's a model. It goes on. Wow. Okay, there's Appendix B. We're page 79 and we've got another 50 pages to go. Pretty amazing. Well, I'll keep on going. Pretty amazing story all up. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others.
Thanks for listening.